of the Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 21 of the 8th canto. And we got up to the first five verses that see that different personalities have come to worship Lord Vamanadeva. So Lord Vamanadeva has expanded into as big as the universe, with all the universe within him. And then he's appeared in his form as Vamanadeva, the dwarf Brahmachari Brahmana again. And all the different great personalities from around the universe, from Brahma to the various sages, have come to offer him prayers. And they've all began worshipping Lord Vamanadeva, the Supreme Spiritual Master. So, text number 6 and 7. They worship the Lord by offering fragrant flowers, water, paja and agya, sandwood pulp and a guru pulp, incense, lamps, fused rice, unbroken grains, fruits, roots and sprouts. Also doing, they offered prayers indicating the glorious activities of the Lord and shouted, Jai, Jai. They also danced, played instruments, sang, sounded conch shells and beat kettle drums in this way, worshipping the Lord. You can just imagine how ecstatic they were all feeling. Jambavan, king of the bears, also joined in the ceremony. And of course, Jambavan is he's also a great devotee of Lord Ramchandra. And so here he is also worshipping Lord Vamanadeva. This is somewhere at the beginning of this Vaivasvata Manu, isn't it? And Lord Vamanadeva, this pastime began in the Chakshusha Manu and has crossed over into the current Vaivasvata Manu, somewhere at the beginning. And this is in can't remember which manu. Did they say it was Vaivasvata or like Shraddhadeva? Can't remember exactly. But as far as I understand, this is before the appearance of Lord Ramchandra. But you see Jambavan.
But even Lord Ramchandra, he's in a different yuga cycle, I heard.
That's right.
This is 27th or 28th yuga cycle of
this
manu.
Yeah, this manu, that's right.
So Krishna appeared in 5,000 years.
Yeah.
But Rama appeared like
1.5 million years ago.
Not in this yuga cycle, but I think 3 or 4 yuga cycles before. That's what I heard.
Even before this yuga cycle.
Yeah, so this is 28th
Yep. And he
But Rama appeared in 23rd or 24th.
Right. So he was in Treta Yuga, wasn't he?
Treta Yuga of that Yuga cycle.
Right. But the previous, right. And then Lord Vamana Dev is before that.
Yeah, maybe.
And Lord Vamana Dev. Hare Krishna. Yeah. From memory, I thought it was Satchi Yuga of one of the cycles, Lord Vamana Dev. But anyway, we'll get to that. It'll all be revealed. Yes, but this is going back. But Jambavan is there, so we have to note that. Jambavan is there during this ceremony to worship Lord Vamana Dev. And of course, that Jambavan was still there when Krishna was here, also. Some of them live for many, many cycles of the Yuga, perhaps the entire Manu and beyond. When the demoniac followers of Maharaj Bali saw that their master, who had been determined in performing sacrifice, had lost all his possessions, to Vamana Dev, who had taken them away on the plea of begging 3 paces of land, they were very angry and spoke as follows. So this is a demon speaking. This Vamana is certainly not a Brahmana, but the best of cheaters. Lord Vishnu, assuming the form of a Brahmana, he has covered his own form, and thus he is working for the interests of the demigods. Our Lord, Bali Maharaj, because of his position in performing the Jagya, has given up the power to punish. Taking advantage of this, our eternal enemy Vishnu, dressed in the form of a brahmachari beggar, has taken away all his possessions. Our Lord Bali Maharaj is always fixed in truthfulness, and this is especially so at present, since he has been initiated into performing, performance of a sacrifice. He is always kind and merciful toward the Brahmanas, and he cannot at any time speak lies. Therefore, it is our duty to kill this Vamana Dev, Lord Vishnu. It is our religious principle and the way to serve our master. After making this decision, the demoniac followers of Maharaj Bali took up their various weapons with a view to killing Vamana Dev. They're very interesting, isn't it? You know, because on the one hand, they're praising Bali Maharaj, that, you know, he's always a truthful person. He's offered to give some charity. He's not going to go back on his word. And especially because he was initiated into performing a sacrifice, is especially situated in truthfulness when you're performing religious ceremonies, sacrificial activities, and he feels that Lord Vishnu has taken advantage of that, so therefore they should kill him. So in other words, they don't care about honouring the truthfulness of Bali. They're happy he's got that quality, but they don't want to honour it. Oh, he has said, you know, I will give charity, therefore I will not refuse now. Right? So they say, oh, that's wonderful, it's so wonderful. But we don't care about the principle of truthfulness. We care about the good qualities of Bali. We don't particularly care about the truthfulness, therefore we don't care that he's done what he should do. We care that Vishnu has taken advantage of it and accepted that charity. So, in other words, Bali's truthful, Vishnu's a cheat. The truthfulness doesn't really matter anyway, so we're going to kill Vishnu. You know, there's a lot of twisted logic there, isn't it? You know, a lot of... As it said, You know, there's no rhyme or reason. Persons engaged in, you know, there's no proper reasoning there, actually. And it doesn't even rhyme. So there's just nothing. There's a little rhyme. Maybe there'll be something, compensation. There's no rhyme or reason. Not even poetic. It's just nonsense. Therefore, it is our duty to kill this varmint the day of Lord Vishnu. It is our religious principle and the way to serve our master. After making this decision, the demoniac followers of Maharaj Bali took up their various weapons with a view to killing Varmada. So you see, here, Bali, he didn't just follow blindly his leader, Sukracharya. He understood that I'm following this guru, this leader, but he's teaching me contradictory things. And so he refused to follow that leader. Whereas the followers of Bali, instead of taking that here, Bali Maharaj, here's our leader, he's actually accepting the proper principles, not contradictory. He's actually accepting proper principles. We should follow him, and he is given to Vishnu, we'll also give to Vishnu. But that's his decision. So they're not following Bali Maharaj to accept Vishnu as someone worthy to give charity everything to. So even though he's following the right thing, actually they're not going to follow him anyway. You know, so it's just every way you look at it, it really comes back to when there's envy of Vishnu or someone, that any excuse to find some fault and, you know, kill them, attack them, cause them trouble. And when it comes to sense gratification, the here is all our property gone from our hands, you know, we want it back, like that. So this is the mentality of those who are envious.
I was thinking about a similar situation in the case of Shiva, the Daksha Yajna.
Mm.
He was insulted and his followers retaliated.
Mm.
And that was also considered as a wrong thing to do. Because here he is following Vishnu, and still his followers are kind of retaliating.
Yeah.
Because he is in a difficult situation, like he's losing everything he has.
Yeah.
And in that situation, Shiva was insulted and he didn't mind it, but his followers took up themselves. So.
Yeah, that's right. So, so therefore, it does show you that, as Prabhupada said, he said the followers always bungle everything. So, you know, Lord Jesus is teaching one thing. He made a sacrifice. He tolerated. Muhammad also was a person who was very much persecuted in his life. If you read the history of his life. The followers do not, that they, you know, they in the name of serving their leader, they really don't follow. Seeing Prabhupada, you know, Prabhupada, his spiritual master said, if you ever get books printed, if you ever get money, print books. And then, you know, because Prabhupada, he was very successful selling books, printing books. But, you know, there were some disciples who criticized him for that, that they, you know, felt that they didn't want to be just selling books. They wanted to be doing higher things. You know, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, the cause mood was, don't work in such a way that you see God, but work in such a way that God will see you. Prabhupada followed that. And but you know, even some of Prabhupada's followers you know, rejected that. In the name of serving ISKCON, you know, there are different devotees who have sort of rejected some of Prabhupada's principles in the name of serving ISKCON. So, you know, so it is a, you know, a common thing. You know, in the name of, just like in the name of serving the public, you know, sometimes people from different political parties kill the public. You know, there are many different contradictory things. It's a very common factor that they're really in the name of following a leader, but when it comes back to it, it appears that they have their own agenda and they tend to rally themselves around like a leader that they all love. So it's like a sentimental thing. Oh, we all love Bali Maharaj, let's fight for him. You know, otherwise they may not fight. But, you know, for Bali, yes, we'll fight. But then they're not really looking at the reason. But the reason doesn't make sense. He doesn't really want us to fight. But no, let's do it for Bali. Oh, Bali, okay, we'll fight. You know, let's do it for the kids. Oh, yes, Shivali. Let's do it for the public. Oh, yes, yes, yes. You know, it's like a, you know, you get a rally cry. And people just don't really think too much about it. You know, this and this is actually the crisis the world faces now. That, you know, you have the groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and so many groups like that. They sort of have a rally cry. They cause massive destruction, you know, to everyone. There's no benefit. Even the people who live under their rule hate them, you know, and want to get away. Even they're Muslim. But still, it's a rally cry, and even though it doesn't make sense, it is a good call to arms, you know. You see, after World War One, you know, in different places in the world, they had the Big Depression. People very, very poor, very poor. Then there was a lot of crime. And then what happened is, when the Second World War came along, it removed the poverty. It was good for business. War is good for business. It's not uncommon when a country is suffering extreme poverty, and the people are really against the government and they're angry at everything. They call the war. They're very happy to quickly go to war, and that war actually increases, the economics of the country, and it rallies people around it. And you know, people will send their sons off to war to be slaughtered in the tens of thousands. But, you know, it's just a very simple rally cry. Oh, you know, these, you know, people or these people or what have you. But people don't really think much into it. You know, they're just very, so it's a very, you know, just a little bit of sentimental fanaticism. And, you know, if there's... people a bit frustrated or anger, you can sort of take that combination, their frustration, their anger. Hey, we've just lost everything. You know, we had everything, it was all gone. And then a little sentimentality, let's do it for Bali. You mix the two together, frustration, anger, oppression, and a sentimental something they can all rally around, then people, you know, racing the war. So it's a very common factor, very common factor that still plays out today. Yeah. We read it here and we laugh, but then when, you know, when we actually read the history of the world, you know, we think, how did they do that, you know? Like they have the 10-year war, the 100-year war. You know, what was that 100-year war over? Why would they keep fighting for 100 years? So it's like this. So O king of the demons, O king, the demons, aggravated by their usual anger, took their lances and tridents in hand, and against the will of Bali Maharaj, they pushed forward to kill Lord Vamadeva. O king, when the associates of Lord Vishnu saw the soldiers of the demons coming forward in violence, they smiled. Taking up their weapons, they forbade the demons to continue their attempt. Now, it's interesting because actually we do the same thing in ISKCON, as we said, that sometimes, you know, so this is a very interesting pastime because, you know, it shows, you know, Bali Maharaj, he's not going to do anything unless it's actually what needs to be done. Even if it costs him everything, he'll only act properly. Arjun was the same. He's only going to do it, he's only going to act if it's needs to be done. If it needs to be done, well then, if he has to sacrifice everything and everyone, it'll be done. And they think it through, and you know, after discussion and deliberation on everything they've heard from solid acharyas and shastra, then they, you know, put things into action. There's really no discussion here amongst the demons. They're like, you know, just, oh, hang on, everyone's things being taken off, you know, there's the culprit. Let's charge in. That's, you know. But we've done that in ISKCON. I remember being in Adelaide, I've mentioned this before, we had a nice temple right in the heart of the city. We were renting it, but as far as preaching, it was perfect location. Big building, and if they had that today, it'd be wonderful, and they probably could have bought it. But, you know, the management decided to get this big, prestigious building. It was sort of like this, very big and prestigious. And very old, but we'd have to pay something like $1,000 a week rent. We weren't going to buy it. We could only rent it. We were never going to be able to buy it.
Is the one now one?
What's that?
The temple now in Adelaide? Is it the one you're talking about?
No, before that one.
Okay.
Yeah, no, much bigger than
that's
that.
That's in the city.
Yeah. This was, and this one was further out in the suburbs.
Okay.
Right? But it was prestigious. To rent it, we had to renovate it. We had to do all this, you know, buy the elaborate, you know, cast iron railings and balconies and things. Cost us hundreds of thousands of dollars, what have you, and renovate stuff because it had to be renovated, a lot of it. So we pumped, you know, so much money into renovation of the owner and the rent, and then it got to the point where, in order to just maintain, we had to shut down the restaurant, the crossways, and every other program, and just send everyone out and just collect money. We need money, just for the rent and this and that. And people, you know, it broke the heart of the devotees.
For renting, that's a fictitious.
What's that?
Renting and then to renovate it, it's not a good call, is it?
Yeah, and then the And then the owners, you know, once we'd renovated it, and paid all that money, they said, oh, we want the building back now, and that was the end of it. But, you know, it was just this rally cry, you know, that was put out. And I always said, no, don't do this, you know, don't. Well, you know, so much money, because
yeah.
I was a saint at time devotee. Plus, I was, you know, always, I was running BBT there, and, you know, so many things. For me, you know, I know, okay, you know, I'm already trying to earn $1,000, $2,000
yeah,
a week.
Exactly. That's very hard. Someone else's
I'm trying to maintain my family,
yeah.
You know, after hours, and maintain other services. Now they're going to double, triple what I'm supposed to do. It's like not even humanly possible. And I know that, you know, my younger godbrothers, you know, that's going to drive them out of the movement. So, but they went ahead. Oh, I know, you know, but it's like a rally cry, just a little rally cry, and, you know, everyone just pours in without really thinking it through, what's happening there. In different cases, we've done similar things in ISKCON, you know, just we really, and this is, of course, why we study the scriptures, because we don't want to follow the demons and just, you know, we actually want to follow people like Bali Maharaj, Arjun. It's not wrong to question everything, because actually a devotee does not like to do even one thing that is he doesn't feel is authorized by Prabhupada, Vamacharya, previous acharyas, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Krishna. If it's not properly authorized, they don't want to do it. Not even one thing. But sometimes even in ISKCON we have been caught out with just a little rally cry, and you'll get the whole community, a whole zone, you know, throw themselves into something which, you know, may not be the right thing. They should be the right direction. But no one will question it until everything collapses. So, you know, from the very beginning, I just heard a lecture today, Prabhupada was saying, he was in Los Angeles, 1968. He said, you all study these books, and then I'll come, that was about December, I think he was saying he'll come back, you know, about the same time next year. He said, and then we'll do the Bhakti Shastri exam. 1968, he was saying that. I don't know whether they actually implemented it. I think he wanted to. I don't know whether they...
They had Bhakti Shastra implemented then.
They did.
There were people doing testing.
Right, yeah. So from the very beginning, Prabhupada wanted, you know, a real good Shastric understanding of why we do things. Not just, you know, of, you know, a little bit of hearsay, like Prabhupada said. For many years, there was a lot of Prabhupada said this, Prabhupada said that, and he didn't really say those things at all. So, you know, some management would say, oh, Prabhupada said, so the whole temple, you know, they'd go on like that for years until someone said, well, actually, Prabhupada didn't say that. Well, they might ask Prabhupada himself. Yeah. O King, when the associates of Lord Vishnu saw the soldiers of the demons coming forward in violence, they smiled. Taking up their weapons, they forbade the demons to continue their attempt. Nanda, Sunanda, Jaya, Vijaya, Prabala, Bala, Kamuda, Kamudakshana, Vishvakshana, Patatrihirat, that's Garuda, Jayanta, Shrutadeva, Pushpadanta, and Satvata. All the associates of Lord Vishnu, they were as powerful as 10,000 elephants, and now they began killing the soldiers of the demons. Now, what do you think of that? There's Jai Vijay there. Mm. What do you think? Any comments? How did they get there? What were they?
Eternal associates.
What's that?
Eternal associates.
They are associates, yeah. There they are. I'll read you something. You know, and what the acharyas do is that they'll read something and they think, Jaya? Turn around, what are they doing there? Didn't they come down as Hiranyaksha, Hiranyakasipu? They've both been killed. That's part of the reason why the demons are so angry in the first place. And they're going to take birth after this as Ravana and Kumbhakarna, right? But here they are as Jaya Vijaya. Still on the side of Vishnu, but they're only supposed to take three births. So the acharyas will read this and they'll question everything. That's why we like them. Hare Krishna. You're just in time for some very interesting discussion here. We're just saying how we're just talking about the demons. They're rushing towards Lord Ramana Dev and they want to kill him. And we're just reading the list of all the associates of the Lord who are as powerful as 10,000 elephants that began killing the soldiers. And it mentions in there about Jaya Vijaya. They're also there.
Among the demons.
Among Vishnu's associates.
Vishnu's.
Right, so remember they were supposed to just take three births as demons. It looks like they're getting an extra little, you know, they're doing an extra tour of duty that they weren't supposed to do. So we're going to see what the acharyas say about that. This is verse 16 and 17 of the 21st chapter, Canto 8. Now, for this, we go back to, and you probably all remember this well, the time, just like yesterday when we did the third canto, chapter 16, text number 29, says, there we read, the Lord then said to his attendants, Jaya and Vijaya, depart this place, right, Vaikuntha, but fear not, all glory is unto you. Though I am capable of nullifying the Brahmana's curse, I would not do so. On the contrary, it has my approval. Now in the purport, it describes this. As explained in connection with text 26, all the incidents that took place had the approval of the Lord. Ordinarily, there is no possibility that the four sages could be so angry with the doorkeepers, nor could the Supreme Lord neglect his two doorkeepers, nor can one come back from Vaikuntha after one's taking birth there. All these incidences, therefore, were designed by the Lord himself for the sake of his pastimes in the material world. Thus, he plainly says that it was done with his approval. And we were just discussing how, a devotee will not do anything without the approval of the Lord. Whereas the demons, even though Bali wanted to give everything to Vishnu, they're saying, oh, look at Vishnu, you know, he's cheating Bali, let's kill him.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. There's room on the end of the desk there as well. We're used to it. Then he plainly says that it was done with his approval. Otherwise, it would have been impossible for inhabitants of Vaikuntha to come back to this material world simply because of a brahminical curse. The Lord especially blesses the so-called culprits. All glories unto you. A devotee, once accepted by the Lord, can never fall down. That is the conclusion of this incident. Now, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments like this. Now, Vishwanath, this is right, Canto 3, Chapter 16, Text number 29, I'm reading from, and now I'm reading Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's translation to that text. And he says, the Lord spoke to his two associates, go to the material world, do not be afraid, you will have good fortune, but also do not go to that world. Though I can nullify the curse of the Brahmana, I do not desire to go against my own rules. So he comments. Seeing that Jaya Vijaya had just arrived, the Lord spoke, go to the material world. Seeing them weeping and wailing, the Lord again spoke to them, his heart softened by compassion. Do not fear, may you too have good fortune. Do not go there. Always remain serving me in Vaikuntha. The negative word ma can be used with both yatam and bodhisattam. Seeing that they were now happy, he said, though I can nullify the curse of the Brahmanas, I do not desire to destroy my own promise. I have made a rule to accept the inevitability of a Brahmana's curse. Just as Garuda sacrificed an expansion of his wing in order to maintain the inevitability of the thunderbolt's power, you should take on the role of demons in one of your expansions and at the same time remain in Vaikuntha in your sarupas. And then Vishvanath Chakravarti Thakur quotes this verse from the Bhagavatam. And he says, later, this passage is found. O king, when the associates of Lord Vishnu saw the soldiers of the demons coming forward in violence, they smiled. Taking up their weapons, they forbade the demons to continue their attempt. Nanda, Sunanda, Jaya Vijaya, etc., etc. For all associates of Lord Vishnu, they're as powerful as 10,000 elephants, and now they began killing the soldiers of the demons. So he continues, he says, in the narration of Vamana and Bali, Jaya and Vijaya are mentioned among the associates of the Lord fighting. But after being born as Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, they would later be born as Ravana and Kumbhakarna. The explanation of their expansions must be given in order to resolve the contradictions of being simultaneously in the form of demons and associates of the Lord. And and Baladev Vidyavasan's comments on this verse of the Bhagavatam in this eighth canto is saying, the Lord said, just like Garuda, out of respect for the thunderbolt, dropped a portion of his wing, so you, out of respect for brahminical power of curse, send a portion of yourself as demons, staying here in the original forms. It is proven by description of Vamana's pastimes, where Jaya and Vijaya are mentioned in the list of the guards in Vaikuntha. So, they remained as associates of Lord Vishnu in Vaikuntha. And you can see that the other interesting thing about this, although they were gatekeepers of the Lord Vishnu in Vaikuntha, and they were engaged, and that Lord Vishnu is within this material universe. So, you know, he's considered to be in Vaikuntha, and that Vaikuntha, that Lord Vishnu is in Vaikuntha, that with his guards, Jaya Vijaya guarding, they're engaged in activities in this universe, in this pastime. Which would tend to indicate that, you know, when the four Kumaras went to Vaikuntha, they went to Vaikuntha in this universe. That's what it tend to indicate. You know. But so they remained as associates of Lord Vishnu, who is here in this universe, dealing with these issues with the demons and what have you. And, another very interesting part of that is how the Lord has a policy that he does not break the curse of a Brahmana. And so one should be very careful thinking that, one is cursed by a Brahmana, one should be very, very careful. But, we do see that Devasamuni, he was a Brahmana, wasn't he? Devasamuni. And you know, he caused offense to and Rish. But in that situation, it was Devasa himself who became in trouble. But you know, we see that with Garuda that, you know, if one understands that, it's very interesting in ISKCON, because sometimes you get devotees who are Brahmanas who don't like each other. They really don't like each other a lot. What to do, you know? Does that mean, you know, one feels like they're cursed by that one, the other one feels like they're cursed by that. And Lord Vishnu, he, in one sense, doesn't like to interfere with the cursing of Brahmanas. And at the same time, like Devas, like Ambarish, he's protecting them. So one has to understand that sometimes one is always protected by Lord Vishnu, as we see with Ambarish. But then sometimes, because two devotees may be at loggerheads, the Lord may want either or both to accept a token of each other's anger as a reaction. And one has to be able to perceive that. Oh, okay, this, it looks like, you know, this is Krishna's will, I'll accept. It's a token of the reaction of that. If that, that, you know, this person has angered me, you know, I've angered them, somehow I have to accept a token of their anger. And sometimes they haven't even been angry. That sometimes, you know, if one offends a Vaishnava, they're not angry at all, but Krishna becomes angry. And he will actually give some reaction. I remember one time, we were doing Adelaide. Adelaide pastime today. I was a grihastha and I had an old Valiant station wagon. It cost me $200. In those days you could buy a car for $200. Good car that. Very reliable. I used it for Sankirtan, I used it for my family. And but you know, it was an old car, so I'd drive it carefully. Anyway, this devotee said to me, I want to borrow your car for the Sankirtan marathon. I said, well, I'm doing the marathon as well. Yeah, but you know, he was like a brahmachari, living amongst the brahmacharis, put it that way. And he was the brother of the temple president, who was the temple president of King's Cross at that stage, Prabhupada disciple. But he wasn't a Prabhupada disciple. And I really didn't want to do it. And, you know, for about a month before the marathon, he said, look, I'll look after your car, but I, you know, I really need that car for the marathon. I said, I really don't want to do this, but I'll do it. But can you promise me, you know, if you wreck this car, you do anything, you have to replace it, because, you know, I need it every day. And it's really going to be difficult for me. I think during that marathon, I went out with someone else who had a car or something. That's what I did. So anyway, at the end of the marathon, I said, how's my car? Where'd you park? He said, oh, we rode it off. You know, we drove it so hard, it just, you know, it's at the wreckers. I said, well, you're going to replace my car? You're going to repair it? You're going to give me a substitute? No. You know, it's all for Krishna, Ganga. You know, stop being so attached. You know. I thought, oh, I got ripped off again. So, you know, it really put me out. It put my whole family out. And I came in the next morning. I was going to say, you know, you can't just do this to me. You've got to, you know, you've got to understand my situation. You know, I can't even live. I can't maintain my family. I can't earn anything with the temple. Anyway, when I came into the Brahmachari ashram, I heard this terrible noise, and he was on the top bunk, and he was like in a fetal position on his belly, sort of thing. And he was like a dry region. You know, he was all night long, he'd been vomiting, and even when there was nothing to vomit, he would just vomit. It's called dry region, you know, and he couldn't stop. It was like, and he turned around and said, I didn't even say anything. He said, Ganga, I'll get your car. I didn't even say anything to him. I go, okay, thanks. So he got his token. his token reaction. He was thinking, you know, I'm Brahmachari, he's just a grihastha, attached grihastha. You know, who cares? They, you know, help them to become detached from their cars. And I'm doing them a favour. That was just common. That's what people think in those days. It was common. So, but anyway, sometimes one has to see that, okay, I have to accept this token reaction. So,
yeah. What you're saying earlier, does that mean that Jain had expanded?
Yes.
And the expansion were Rakshasas, but they were with Vishnu still. So they were doing both?
Both, yeah.
So they were doing both. That's what it means.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Krishna, when they were down, he said that, yes, you stay with me, you go down. So they have expanded.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we could have just whipped through here, like, because it's all story without purpose, but not on my watch. Might as well get as much nectar as we can. So when Bali Maharaj saw that his own soldiers were being killed by the associates of Lord Vishnu, he remembered the curse of Sukracharya and forbade his soldiers to continue fighting. Avipachiti, Arahu, Onemi, please hear my words. Don't fight. Stop immediately, for the present time is not in our favour. So he's actually accepting the curse of Sukracharya as as the will of Vishnu, because the Lord's right in front of him. Nothing will happen without the will of the Lord. As we heard in that purport. O Daitas, by human efforts, no one can supersede the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who can bring happiness and distress to all living entities. The Supreme Time Factor, which represents the Supreme Person, was previously in our favour, and not in favour of the demigods, but now that same time factor is against us. No one can surpass the time representation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead by material power, by the council of ministers, by intelligence, by diplomacy, by fortresses, by mystic mantras, by drugs, by herbs, or by any other means. It is very interesting, you know, for practicing astrology amongst Vaishnavas, because, you know, sometimes devotees come to me for compatibility, and they want to go ahead with the compatibility. And one of the things I have to do, apart from above and beyond seeing the astrological factors there, is to actually then separately to see the will of the Lord, which is, you know, and that's, you know, Śrīla Bhaktisiddhānta Sarasvati Thakura, you know, he's often quoted on that, that, you know, astrology doesn't, you know, he gave it up on you know, on the pretext that it doesn't show the will of the Lord. Of course, you know, in some cases, as we've said, that astrology very much showed the will of the Lord. In the case of personalities like Prabhupada and, you know, Brigit Maharaj and what have you, you know, that it was quite plainly stated, this will happen, this will happen. It'd be like this. So, but in other instances, the will of the Lord, due to current circumstances, may not necessarily be explicitly stated in a person's astrology chart, in the sense that, you know, a person has taken up devotional service not necessarily because it's providence, but because they've been delivered by devotees. And having been delivered by devotees, their previous destiny has now been changed. You know, it wasn't, not necessarily everyone who becomes a devotee, it's their destiny they'll be a devotee in this life. So many will become devotees by the force of the Sankirtan movement, not necessarily, and nor will the level of advancement they make, is that necessarily or destined. They can take the full measure of what may be destined, and then they may go further, and some may fall back from that. And therefore, there's a little bit of fluidity in what is the will of the Lord. So sometimes they're asking for compatibility. I know sometimes where the compatibility is enough, but I have to consider the factors. Yes, this is, I can see the hand of the Lord in this. Okay, then do it. Or the compatibility is good, and I see the hand of the Lord. No, don't. Don't do this. Like that. Yeah. So that has to be taken into consideration, not just the compatibility. So it's very helpful for an astrologer, or, you know, for a devotee, even for a spiritual master, to actually have some understanding, some discussions with the disciple, as to what circumstances are there in, you know, what is brought about this situation. So, again, very interesting point. Sometimes devotees approach the spiritual master as if the spiritual master, because he's the spiritual master, he will know everything. I'm shy to tell him anything, and so I won't tell him all the things that's on my mind, and he'll just give me an answer. And he'll say, yeah, marry this person, and without even knowing who the girl is or who the boy is. And it actually may be wrong. Actually, the spiritual master needed a bit of, you know, may need to have some background upon, you know, what's the circumstances. Let me have a look at the will of the Lord in this. Not just that, oh, someone has given a 60% compatibility. You know, the spiritual master actually has to have a discussion with them, and those people approaching, they actually have to have a discussion, you know, so that they can perceive what is the will of the Lord there. And I've actually had circumstances where I've had to undo even marriages where the guru said yes, and it was, should never have happened. Or that the guru said no, and it should have happened. And then it did happen. And it's beneficial, you know, so both. So, and I've noticed in all of those cases, it was, there was insufficient discussion between the devotees and that senior Vaishnavas, and therefore the will of the Lord was not really properly perceivable. And sometimes one of the things that happens, the problems, is that the discussion is not between the spiritual master saying yes, go ahead, and the couple wanting to get married, but it's actually the spiritual master with some management in a particular temple, it could be in India, it could be here, it could be anywhere, and that, and the wrong opinion is being given, because sometimes management, you know, they, you know, marriage is sometimes not necessarily what's convenient for the couple, what's convenient for the temple, you know. Oh, we're gonna lose our best Sankirtan devotee, you know, this is our biggest, you know, collector, whatever like that. So the spiritual master may get the wrong impression, see? So, you know, the will of the Lord has to be taken into consideration, and to do that, you know, you know, devotees should have proper discussion. You know, generally with Srila Prabhupada, you know, even some of his stature, who was able to, you know, talk directly to Krishna, still it was his policy to discuss where possible with the persons involved about the decisions that needed to be made. You know, he had that, he liked to discuss properly, not that, you know. You know, there are occasions where Srila Prabhupada, many occasions where Srila Prabhupada just understood, you know, the will of the Lord without much discussion. So he was on that level. But still, it wasn't a policy of Prabhupada that I know what Krishna wants, there's no need for discussion, you do this, you do that. That wasn't a policy of Prabhupada. If at all possible, you know, he would have the discussion. And then, you know, perceiving the will of Krishna sometimes, either through that discussion or during that discussion, he would make decisions.
Prabhu, normally when you're looking at astrological compatibility,
yeah,
doesn't the compatibility itself indicate the will of the Lord?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. It can.
Yeah, but then what do you mean by saying that apart from seeing compatibility, you also see the will of the Lord? Because I thought, when you see the compatibility,
yeah,
you're also seeing that maybe when you're saying some people are not compatible, you're saying that that's really that Krishna's, you may like that person, but somehow you're not destined to be with that person.
Yeah. Because Prabhupada mentions in the Srimad Bhagavatam that if the couple of Krishna consciousness, then the compatibility is there, there's no need to see other factors. If they're Krishna conscious, they'll have good qualities and they'll cooperate in their Krishna consciousness and get along. In the spiritual world, we all get along. But if they're Krishna conscious and they're coming to the transcendental platform, they'll get along, just like they do in the spiritual world. And they'll cooperate in their marriage and like that. But the difficulty is that obviously the level of Krishna consciousness, when that's lacking, then the compatibility, according to the charts, must be there. Now, if Krishna senses that, for instance, okay, here is a compatibility which is not sufficient, but the Krishna consciousness, this association between these two will produce, they're good for each other's Krishna consciousness. That will override the previous just compatibility within the chart. You know, the Krishna consciousness factor which Krishna can perceive overrides any previous destiny. That's the point. That in this life, when we become devotees, our destiny will change. So Prabhupada put it this way. One time, you know, someone wrote a letter to Prabhupada. What is our destiny, you know, related to astrology chart? Prabhupada said you have two destinies. One destiny is, you know, what you see in your chart. And if you surrender to Krishna, your other destiny is Krishna's destiny. It's the destiny of Krishna. That's different. It says, but if you give up your Krishna consciousness, then what is there in the chart? You get all that back again. Now, then, of course, it's not karma, but Krishna's still dishing it out personally, but it's like that. You know? So that means that, for instance, let's take that. Say someone comes to get a compatibility at the very beginning while they're completely conditioned. There's not much Krishna consciousness. So you might look at that compatibility. That's the main thing, because we can't guarantee their Krishna consciousness. Then look at that and later on they're really Krishna conscious. And say there wasn't a compatibility and then they're really Krishna conscious, we may say go ahead. And then after they've been really Krishna conscious, and they come after that stage where they start to fall away, and we say, oh, well, you can't say anymore their Krishna consciousness get married. Then you say, oh, no, don't. It would depend, wouldn't it, you know, on whether they're coming at the beginning, where their Krishna consciousness is guaranteed, when they're at the peak and they're really Krishna conscious, you have a lot of faith in them. Or they, you know, one of them's they're thinking, oh, as soon as I get a good husband, a good wife, that's it for me. I've got what I want. I'm sort of, you know, it's too much work. And Krishna notes that, and he's saying, you know, say the will of the Lord, he's saying, oh, let's not match this person up. So it really would depend, wouldn't it? Because as Prabhupada said, there are different destinies. One there in the chart, one with Krishna. And then if you give up your Krishna consciousness, you go back to the one there. You there, Nirmala? I'm not putting you to sleep or anything.
No. This is, but I'm thinking about this
Krishna
consciousness thing. I understood what you said, that you have to see the will of the Lord. That's what I didn't understand, because so long as...
Well, you have to try.
Consciousness,
yeah.
So long the person's Krishna consciousness, like people say... in fact, I've heard this many times. They say, why do you want to see astrology? Prabhupada said, both the devotees, you don't have to see. I've heard a lot about this, seeing for Sveta and all that.
Mm.
Then it makes sense that when, so long as you're a devotee, it doesn't matter. But then suppose if you just have the circumstances, in difficult circumstances, you are leaving your Krishna consciousness, all that has an effect. And people tend, in difficult circumstances, they don't know how they will react. They could. But how when you're saying that in the compatibility of seeing the will of the Lord, apart from this, what is the additional thing that, you're seeing, like you're saying, when you're seeing the compatibility, you're seeing something additional. What are you seeing? That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Well, it's like this, that, so for instance, Lord Shiva, he's also a great astrologer, believe it or not. In fact, a lot of the science of astrology comes through from him. He teaches it. And when you actually do an astrological reading for someone, so it's all that mathematics is there and everything is shown there. Above and beyond that, there are omens, and the omens represent currently what the super soul is revealing to you.
Sorry, I didn't catch that word.
Omens.
Omens, okay.
So, if a person at the time of approaching you, you know, there's a science where, taught by Lord Shiva, you know, where you note whether you're breathing in and through your left nostril or your right nostril, or both evenly. You heard of that? Yeah. One's pingala and the other one's
Ida.
What?
Ida.
Yeah.
Ida and pingala.
Yeah. And the third one is the bow. And one confirms that what they want to do will fail, and the other one says what they want to do will be successful. Now, so those things change within a second, but also there are certain events in the lives of the persons who want to get married where you can see that arrangements were made which are beyond, you know, they're specific, very helpful arrangements for them to be together. It's like the super soul has made an arrangement above and beyond what was possible, something nice happened. There are many different omens, you know, different birds flying and chirping, you know. You don't want, you know, when someone's saying, yes, I'd like to marry this girl, and a flock of crows flies over from the left and starts squawking around, flying around in circles. It's like, oh, you might want to think twice about this, you know. But, you know, if... So there are very auspicious omens, there are very inauspicious omens. And that is the super soul literally speaking right there on the spot, because they're just very circumstantial, you know, with the animals and the birds and the weather patterns and so many different things. But, you know, so there are activities that are going on in the lives of the couple, there are activities that are going on the time of the astrological things. There are a lot of different factors that despite the obstacles that the couple may have to get married, or the opposition that may be there for the couple, that's a different thing. It's whether there's auspicious omens that, you know, different circumstances that indicate that something should happen. So... you know, that is, you know, but this, you know, in certain, for instance, certain omens indicate that the attempts of inauspicious persons will fail, and the attempts of auspicious persons will succeed, because they're all part of the same circumstance. So say two people want to get married, there's inauspicious people say, oh, they can't get married, you know, and others saying they can. So it's like in the Battle of Kurukshetra. I think it was Karna. Someone asked Karna, you know, can the war be stopped? Like something like Karna said, no, the omens are there. They, you know, he described different omens, the astrological features and everything like that. And then he himself understood that. But this is inauspicious for those who are impious, not for the pious. Yeah. So there are omens which are inauspicious for the impious, and that means it's good for the pious. So, you know, it's a very big science, the whole thing, but, you know, say... So, like with anything, you know, one has to practice. So if one wants to be a doctor, one wants to be a lawyer, you want to, you know, fly an aeroplane, you know, a person who's flying a jet, they get a feel for it, and, you know, things spin out of control, they sort of can get it back in, you know, things like that. The slightest little thing, they understand something's good, something's not good. They can deal with very extreme conditions because they're, you know, that's their profession. Astrology is like that, but astrology, one actually must be a devotee. That's what Parasaras is. And this is the interesting thing. Parasara is saying the qualification to be a devotee, one must to be an astrologer, must be a devotee of the Lord. And the devotees are saying devotees shouldn't be astrologers. How can we understand, you know, astrology? In other words, if we've got changing destinies because people are taking to devotional service, and then astrology, just like when we become devotees, we don't give up medicine. Oh, just whatever Krishna wills, you know, with my health. You know, I'm sick. Oh, it must be Krishna's will. I'll just suffer and die. No, we get some medicine, we fix our health. Astrology is a thing of making adjustments in our life, which is, you know, helpful. That's all it is, like medicine. Make this adjustment. Astrology, make that adjustment. Don't go left, go right. You know. Even with medicine, even devotees with medicine, they get a sense of what Krishna, you know, if you have an illness, you know, the 20 devotees are telling you, oh, eat lemongrass, you know. You know, six times a day and fast from everything else for 6 months. You know, and someone else is saying, you know, oh, you know, Prabhupada would just eat kachoris and, you know, fried things and he was all right. And someone else says, just, you know, just eat tulsi leaves. And someone else is saying, you know, get a, you know, a jab of this from the doctor. And someone's saying, get naturopath. You get about 50 devotees telling you, right? You've got to have a sense of where Krishna's guiding you as to what is going to fix you, isn't it? And one may say, oh, it's my destiny to get sick. You know? No. You know, if you don't take your medicine, yes. So marriage is like that, you know. We don't want an unhealthy marriage. So, you know, there's advice. There's a lot of different advice. But you need to take Krishna's indication along with the advice you're getting. Just like medical field, so many different advice. Astrological field, you'll also get many different advices. You, in above all of that, you have to take Krishna's, you know, understanding. And Srila Prabhupada specifically gives the example. He said his family doctor, who was a very good doctor, was treating someone with some very serious problem in the throat, and the doctor couldn't cure him, and he was getting worse. And Prabhupada's doctor, the family doctor, said, you go and see such and such an astrologer. So the Prabhupada's telling this story to verify astrology as a great science. And he said, the astrologer said, oh, the doctor's treating you for this, but you don't have that disease, you have this desire. The astrologer's not even a medical person. He went back to the doctor. He told his doctor, you know, the astrologer said, I have that. The doctor treated him for that and he was cured straight away. So even sometimes the doctors get it wrong. I know with my wife, when she got cancer, she went there, she thought she had an infection. It was about 10 years ago. They thought she had an infection in her breast. So they were going to give her antibiotics and things like that. She was wondering whether the lumps were cancer, and they said no. As an astrologer, I said to her, I see something far more serious than what antibiotics will, you know. What I see is that you're capable of, you know, having something fatal, you know, very soon. Anyway, she pushed and pushed the doctors to examine. They couldn't see it in the breast, but when they did finally see it, because the mammograms can only pick up to a certain level, but when they saw it, what they didn't see is, because they weren't examining the other parts, it had gone right through all the lymph glands. So I was saying there was something there, and they were saying not. So then they understood, although we've just been able to see what's there by our machines, what we weren't looking anywhere else. And at that stage, they had to put her in the hospital, major operations, took all the lymph glands out and everything like that. Had they left her, it was about 10 years, she would have died within, you know, 3 or 4 months. It was, you know, lymph glands just would have spread right through her body. So, now as far as my understanding is, what his spiritual master himself said, my spiritual master said, Krishna saved you from the hands of the jaws of death. My understanding is her destiny, she could have died right there and then, you know, back then. And then Krishna said, because she's doing well in her Krishna consciousness, let's give her extra time. That's my understanding, that she could have died then. But there, you know, the point being that in that case, I could have just looked at her chart and said, I think you're going to die in 6 months. Couldn't I? I could have just looked at her chart and said, oh, you know, there's something there, but I don't know what it is. The doctor said you don't have anything, but, you know, whatever happens, you can't change. It's in your destiny. You could die in 6 months. Maybe it's something else. You know, as you can see, a devotee can't be, when you're dealing with Krishna consciousness, where you have the ability that Krishna can adjust your destiny, you actually have to look whether Krishna, you know, Krishna is giving you assistance to increase the maximum benefit you're going to get from this life so that you get the best opportunity to go back to Godhead, since you're practicing Krishna consciousness. Or if Krishna sees that somehow or another you're ready, he may just finish up straight away. Or if Krishna sees that this person is wasting their opportunity, he may finish it up straight away. So you have to, and marriage, you know, is something which Krishna sees. He says, I am that sex life. I am that marriage arrangement. It is something that he understands, that sometimes what's shown up in the destiny may not give the decision makers exactly all the information they need, because that destiny is being adjusted by Krishna because of their level of devotional service, either increasing or decreasing. So therefore the will of the Lord has to be taken into account above and beyond what is seen. So one can see, you can see a certain amount of devotees, you can see, oh yeah, no wonder you're a devotee, and this person would do quite well in the devotional service in this life. But then there's a certain point where they get to the point which is destined, because they get to the point where they left off. And that's a given. You know, Krishna says in the Gita, even without seeking, they'll come to a certain point where they left off in their past life. They'll come to that consciousness. So you can see that far. What they do then, are they going to take the opportunity and finalize in that life? Or do they just make a few percent more and stay somewhere on that level? See? So some things you can see in the chart. Although, you know, oh, they'll come very quickly at this point. And seeing that, they've got a really good opportunity attaining complete perfection, but they may not. And therefore, even some aspects of how well a devotee has been situated in their last life, you can see. Whether they go all the way, that's still, you know, up to a person. Yeah. You there?
This marriage charts... Krishna's time, they never were tried to see the marriage chart. Krishna married 16,108 wives, no marriage charts. Arjun married 5-6 wives, no marriage chart. They just pick up a wife and move on. Because
Chachis can do that. They're very wealthy. Prabhupada says you can marry.
Because there was a social support, that the social support supported the marriage. What is happening in these days is there is no social support for marriage. In fact, the social support is for breaking the marriage these days.
It is. But Kshatriyas, you know, if they get a marriage proposal, they sort of, it's not chivalrous to refuse it. If
exactly.
A woman really, you know, take shoulder, you know, please, marry me. Would you marry me? That is my only hope in their life. You marry me. The attraction is there. The kshatriyas must. That is part of it. If someone challenges in a fight, they must. A woman.
To me, it looks like more than the chart is the social support, which is important for marriage to last or not last.
Yes, but given the fact that there's no social support,
that's right.
You'd want a good compatibility.
In fact, the social support these days is to break the marriages.
It is. Therefore, the better compatibility you got and the more Krishna consciousness support there is, the better. So given the fact that everything is against marriage, you really want to make sure that they're somehow well suited. And quite often, if you don't know a person's Krishna consciousness, because actually the majority of devotees, even if they're chanting 16 rounds and what have you, it means very little to me. Because it's not just that. There has to be something about, perhaps they're, as you're saying, it's more like their devotional support.
Yes.
If they're attracted to certain, they got a nice attraction to certain nice, solid devotees, that's very helpful. Because a lot of devotees are chanting, etc. like that. When they get married, a lot of it just fades right away, the studies. And really, they just absorb themselves in family life. Popping into the Sunday feast and the feast and the festivals and things like that. But the real Krishna consciousness is, it sort of just really disappears a lot. And sometimes, people will chant a lot more to get the good boy. That's very common. I said to you this once before, when a woman's going to get married and when a man's going to get married. Right? Women, they're looking for a husband when they start to lose a lot of weight. Men, when their hair's starting to grow, they're looking for a wife. They're looking a little bit more attractive. That's a fact. The young ones. These days, even the older ones. So, But also, it's always walking around with a bead bag on. Krishna, that's about it. They do that. They'll literally do that. They walk around beads, always around, attracting. So, therefore, I try and see what's actually in the chart, whether they've got a good something in the past life is solid as well. This person's chanting. And you can see this person has a real solid faith in God, like that. Or you can see, this person's really, they actually, they're really opposed to religious restraints and principles. They can very easily quarrel with a superior person, when it comes down to adult, a superior person will present something and they'll very find fault in that person to avoid. You can actually see that in people's charts. So
and also in my observation, it's the lady, if she wants to keep the marriage, she can keep it, and if she wants to break it, she can break it. Her decision is more dominating than the man's decision in general. Men don't so much. Don't care about marriage.
I'm going to ask. Any comments? No comments.
I don't think
so. No. Yeah.
Sorry.
A bit of disagreement there.
It differs from person to person. I don't think it's not a gender statement.
Yeah.
Well, different observations probably. But
I'll have to ask Nima, let me get.
I don't agree.
She doesn't agree. What about men? I've got to get a consensus here. We'll do a democratic vote.
I've seen because of men also there's divas. So.
Yeah. It seems to be an individual thing.
most of the divorce cases are filed by the women, not by the men so much.
Bali Maharaj ki jai. Bali Maharaj ki jai, yeah. All right. Let's get back to Shastra.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.
What I feel is, with our two hands, you can't clap together.
Well, everything is there. But
otherwise, it's a Buddhist clap, right?
But the
no one hears.
So
but the statistic doesn't say that same thing.
Yeah, regarding the earlier point about why in previous ages there was no compatibility, I was just thinking maybe it's because Varnashrama was still intact and.
Yeah, social support.
People coming from the same
social support
varna were expected to have certain qualities, so there was not much of dispute whether there was any compatibility. So Kshatriya would marry somebody from the Kshatriya background.
Well, actually, Prabhupada says that they did do compatibility.
Yeah,
they always have.
I have in the same way they see compatibility.
Yeah.
It was more
previously. Well, in Prabhupada's books, he quotes compatibility when he speaks about it. He quotes that this has always been the system and it was always followed. I mean, so, you know, there are exceptions, but from what I've understood from Srila Prabhupada's books, that is the system that actually was prevalently always followed. That's what he says. And in his lectures, he speaks, you know, in favour of that, but he does mention that, of course, above everything is one's Krishna consciousness, and Srila Prabhupada emphasised that, but, you know, the, one's natural propensities to work, and as far as suitable partner, must be taken into consideration. Generally, we do that. We try to take, you know, if someone is more management, administrative, someone is more brahminical, preaching, someone is more working in the fields, Prabhupada would take that into consideration very significantly, that that's the best, that let them do according to their natural propensities. Whether in marriage or what have you, that was stable. Because if a person's Krishna consciousness wanes, they remain steady because they're naturally situated. If their Krishna consciousness wanes and they're not even naturally situated according to their usual propensities of work, then they're going to, you know, fall away from both things. See, so it's like the safety net that, and therefore, I see the compatibility as a very important safety net. That even if they become Krishna conscious, you know, as I said, I don't give a lot of credit to, you know, people are chanting, what have you, but. You know, sometimes it's up until the point of marriage, it means something, and then with marriage, it really, you know, what they've done just disappears. And then in marriage, when the Krishna consciousness is waning, you sort of, people fall back on their conditioning. So then, at that point, the safety net is, are these people somewhat compatible according to their chart, which means that if their Krishna consciousness wanes, they'll still like each other and want to be married to each other. And then because they're sort of just friendly to the devotees, gradually after 10 years or 15 years, they may come back into their, you know, some real solid Krishna consciousness like that. But someone who's, what happens, someone gets married in Krishna consciousness and their marriage is not compatible, their Krishna consciousness wanes, when their marriage breaks up, they leave ISKCON and blame ISKCON for organising a farcical situation all round. And it's a devastating situation for their spiritual life. So compatibilities, And engaging people according to their natural work is very, very important, so that long term, any problem with their Krishna consciousness, they're sort of just stable and happy at least, and that prosperous.
Some people even say that the divorce rate is higher in ISKCON than outside ISKCON.
Who are those people? Some people say. If people follow, then they will get a better rate of marriage. And if they don't follow, then basically, they will get, as Prabhupada said, if you leave your destiny with Krishna, you go back again to what's there just in the chart. You know, your fate depends upon what was in your chart, that sort of destiny. You go back to that. If in someone's chart they just got a really weak marriage chart, is sort of doomed, and they give up their Krishna consciousness, and whatever little Krishna consciousness they had was maintained in the marriage, and they give up their Krishna consciousness, they go back to what's in their chart that they're conditioning, because as soon as you're not Krishna consciousness, then you're just acting according to a lot of conditioning, and that conditioning breaks up the marriage. So when we say in Krishna consciousness, it means someone practicing Krishna consciousness actually always has a better marriage rate of not separation. Not practicing Krishna consciousness, practically, you know, things are doomed in Kali Yuga for everyone. And quite often, you know, when you see people without Krishna consciousness, even they maintain their marriage, they don't like each other, they don't get along, there's no happiness there. You know, the children don't like the parents, parents don't like the children. A lot of troubles. But yes, you know, this is the whole point of this conversation, that sometimes devotees in management positions or even guru positions, without proper analysis to see the will of Krishna and perhaps the safety net of a compatibility, are just sort of somehow, if a senior person says go ahead, that's enough, you know. And I've seen that happen. A senior person says, oh well, you found someone, did you? Okay, that's good enough, get married. You know, it can be a big headache, actually, you know, for a person in you know, who has hundreds or thousands of disciples. You know, it's a real major job.
It's a big
listening
job.
To what the lady is saying, what the man is saying, and what the relatives are saying, and you know what the temple is saying. You know, to get people married, and it's a big thing. And sometimes the easy path may be taken, but it shouldn't be. Actually, we have to examine the will of the Lord, and we actually have to, you know, examine the compatibility. That's proper. And to do that, every temple should have a dedicated department for that. Because someone may be able to look after the finances and be, you know, or keep the courtyard clean and the, you know, the prasadam hall clean. That doesn't make them the authority that they can look at what's involved in getting two people properly situated. But in ISKCON, that's our system. If someone's in a position of authority, that's good enough. There doesn't need to be a department. There doesn't have to be qualified people. That's enough. If the temple's making money, that's enough. You know, books are going out, that's enough. Yeah, you two can get married, you two can't.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.
Yeah, okay. The will of the Lord. And look at Bali Maharaj, you know, he's seeing the will of the Lord through Sukracharya, etc. And anyway, so now purport, Bhagavad Gita mentions five causes of defeat or victory. Of these five, Deva, providence, is the most powerful. See, above everything, the will of the Lord, providence. Nacha devat param balam. Bali Maharaj knew the secret of how he had formerly been victorious because providence was in his favour. Now, since that same providence was not in his favour, there was no possibility of his victory. Thus, he very intelligently forbade his associates to fight. Providence, that's will of the Lord, the will of time, now. You know, what is the time factor saying now? You know, okay, we have the previous chart, what you're born into. These are the circumstances, this is what people are saying, all the different. But providence, right here and now, that is the final say. Who is looking at that? Who is qualified to see that? Unless providence is in our favour, we shall not be able to gain victory. Therefore, we must wait for that favourable time when our defeating them will be possible. Sukadeva Goswami continued, O King, in accordance with the order of their master, Bali Maharaj, all the chiefs of the demons and the daitas entered the lower regions of the universe to which they were driven by the soldiers of Vishnu. Thereafter, on the day of Somapana, after the sacrifice was finished, Garuda, the king of birds, understanding the desire of his master, arrested Bali Maharaj with the ropes of Varuna. Purport. Garuda, the constant companion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, knows the confidential part of the Lord's desire. Bali Maharaj's tolerance and devotion were undoubtedly super excellent. Garuda arrested Bali Maharaj to show the entire universe the greatness of the king's tolerance.
The ropes of Varuna, that means the ropes of water or what?
The ropes of Varuna, yeah. Evidently, Varuna has very good ropes. Good quality. You can't get out. You're caught in the ropes of Varuna, that's it. Don't bother.
In some pictures, they show the snakes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they may be personalities. Yeah. Like Nagas and Varuna, yeah. Mm. When Bali Maharaj was thus... Let's have a look. Let's consult the authoritative pictures. Is there a picture there? And this is the guy. So you probably don't have pictures, right? Because you've got the laptops. Anyone?
Yeah.
You've got? Yeah.
By the snake?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In those days... They could shoot arrows and then there would snakes appear. They would shoot arrows and the water would appear. So Garuda also would have all those powers. He should be able to, if you want.
Yes.
Ropes and all should be not
great for. Yeah, so he is that, there you go. There's and these pictures would have been passed by Srila Prabhupada. There's a definite snake tying up Varuna. Maybe a few of them. It's hard to tell. Yeah. When we see that Garuda, someone, the more confidentially one knows Krishna, the more one can understand providence or the will of the Lord. So, therefore, we see that actually, again, in ISKCON, management should not just be one's economic ability, one's organizational ability, one's ability to suppress or empower, but amongst all management, actually, it should be understood that devotees with bhakti, who are obviously very dear to the Lord, have a say in management to understand the will of the Lord, because it is not up to other, you know, different qualifications like that. That has to be part of the management setup. And therefore, our ultimate authority is Srila Prabhupada, because he knows the will of the Lord, and therefore our whole GBC is based upon an authority system based upon implementing Prabhupada's will, by understanding Prabhupada's will, we understand the will of the Lord, and therefore in everything we do, part of making a decision is what is Prabhupada's will in this situation, because that represents providence. That represents the will of the Lord. And, there are different, Prabhupada's will there's sometimes different pastimes that we have in ISKCON, where Prabhupada obviously revealed what he wants, even through some unknown, nice devotees, but not known to so much to the authorities, that this person would somehow, present something which would convince them, oh yes, we feel Prabhupada's presence, and actually we can see this is Prabhupada's will. So when Bali Maharaj was thus arrested by Lord Vishnu, who is the most powerful, there was a great roar of lamentation in all directions throughout the upper and lower planetary systems of the universe. So they're all lamenting. Now here's Garuda, he's happy because the will of Vishnu has been executed. And throughout the whole universe, everyone else is, oh, what is happening to Bali? O King, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vamanadeva, then spoke to Bali Maharaj, the most liberal and celebrated personality, whom he had arrested with the ropes of Varuna. Bali Maharaj had lost all bodily lustre, but he was nonetheless fixed in his determination. Purport. When one is bereft of all his possessions, he is certainly reduced in his bodily lustre. But although Bali Maharaj had lost everything, he was fixed in his determination to satisfy Vamanadeva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In Bhagavad Gita, such a person is called Stita Pragya. A pure devotee is never deviated from the service of the Lord, despite all difficulties and impediments offered by the illusory energy. Generally, men who have wealth and opulence are famous, but Bali Maharaj became famous for all time by being deprived of all his possessions. This is the special mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead toward his devotees. The Lord says, Yashyaham anugranam hi harishyeta dhanam shanai. As the first installment of his special favour, the Lord takes away all the possessions of his devotee. Notice Prabhupada says, as the first installment. Because, as I mentioned in class, Srimad Bhagavatam class the other day, Prabhupada says that it's temporary because, he does that to help them in their surrender, because they may be hanging on to something material that they're struggling to give up. But then once he forcefully takes everything away, then he just gives them so much, even more than what they had previously. So it's the first installment, not the final episode. A devotee, however, is never disturbed by such a loss. He continues his service and the Lord amply rewards him beyond the expectations of any common man. See, there it says there. So a lot of people, a lot of devotees quoting that, leave that last part out. And which is sort of, a bit scary to people listening to their class, Oh, yeah, well, Krishna will give you some special favour, he'll take everything off you. And some of the new devotees start exiting.
Just a very quick question.
Yes.
Actually, though Mali Maharaj lost everything, he lost everything material.
Mm.
But he had gained spiritual, because he had been determined to give it to Lord Vishnu.
Mm-hmm.
Because, right. So, actually, his body.
Swami Master should have increased. That's where I didn't understand why, just because of losing material opulences, why should his body master should go down? Because he was exalted. I didn't understand that thing that he just why they say that his body master has gone down.
Yeah. Well, Bali Maharaj is in the process of surrendering everything. He's got one more step to, you know, to give, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He's in the process of surrendering everything, including his own self. Arjun was in the process of surrendering to Krishna. He also lost his bodily luster. Because he felt that he was going to lose everything as well, either by fighting or not fighting, everything would be lost. He also lost his bodily luster. So Prabhupada, he said when he was in India, so he'd left his family, taken sannyas, and then, so he said, so difficult. You know, those days were so difficult. He had nothing. Literally wandering around, no house, no family, no money, no followers. His God Brothers movement was in disarray. You know, like, you know, no ISKCON, or, you know, imagine that. And then when he was walking through the streets, a bull, gored him, knocked him to the ground and injured him. You know? And Prabhupada said, I was thinking, perhaps I've done the wrong thing. You know, taking sannyas, leave my family. You know, he felt like that. Yeah, perhaps I've done the wrong thing. He thought like that. See? But Bali Maharaj is, you know, he's in this position. He's going to give everything. Now he's suddenly tied up within a moment like that. You know, the glory of Bali Maharaj, the glory of Prabhupada is not that, you know, because he's a pure devotee, he surrendered, but it was easy for him because he was a pure devotee. You know, Bali Maharaj is a pure devotee. It was easy for him. He's a pure devotee, so he surrendered, you know. He's a great sadhu. It's not a big thing. The glory of Bali Maharaj, the glory of Arjun, the glory of Prabhupada, is that this surrendering was as difficult as we can imagine surrendering being.
It's not that because they are pure devotees, they are surrendering. But it is because they surrender, they become pure devotees.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And even Prabhupada, in the sense that, you know, he's Nitya Siddha, still going through the process of surrendering for our instruction. So literally, if you look at Prabhupada's life, he almost goes from a neophyte, you know, a family man, you know, and gradually it appears that he goes through the stages of becoming a pure devotee. But then if you look at his life, the fact that he never ever, you know, was without Krishna, never, you know, forgot Krishna and what have you, you see that he's a Nitya Siddha. But still, that process of surrendering to Krishna's will, okay, in Prabhupada's life, I'm thinking, you know, the comfortable way to do this is to, you know, stay in India. I'm used to being here in India and, you know, to do what I'm used to doing, you know, making money through my business, and then perhaps I can then purchase this, that and the other. You know, that's what's familiar to me, you know, if I just keep going. But I'm sort of being pushed to do something that's, you know, unfamiliar, or I ordinarily wouldn't doing. You know, I'm not intending to take sannyas, you know. I'm not intending to leave my family. I'm not intending to just, you know, wander over to a foreign country penniless, you know. He wasn't intending to do that. You know, he actually, okay, but it seems the will of Krishna is I have no choice. You know, I'm being forced into that. So, but he appears to be going through that surrendering process to show us the normal way that one would think as one is making the next step towards Krishna and how we would deal with that. So we can actually, you know, follow each and every step of Prabhupada's life, apply it in our own life, whether it's a grihastha, brahmachari, sannyas, vanapras, we can actually follow that and know the difficulties and what Prabhupada thought about it and the difficulties and how he, what was, you know, his realizations that pushed him forward to the next step. We take those realizations at that level. So, Bali Maharaj here also. So, you know, he is, we sometimes have this tendency to think of pure devotees as, you know, so here says he lost his bodily luster. Well, who wouldn't? You know, everything you own. So we sometimes, you know, think of pure devotees in this sense. Well, Bali Maharaj, you know, he's a very exalted personality. Take everything off him, he wouldn't bat an eyelid. But he did. You know, he's lost his bodily luster. He's just like, you know, pale. And then bound, ready to be punished, humiliated. So, what makes one perfect is not that one has no natural reactions to the difficulties one undergoes in the process of going back home to Godhead and becoming completely detached from everything in this world. What makes one perfect is that one follows in the footsteps of those who are perfect. That's what makes one perfect. For instance, the one who delivers the mail. The person who delivers the mail, you know, if someone brings the mail and say the government has given a tax return, there's $20,000, he's going to deliver it. Now that post office person, someone may say, you're not qualified to deliver $20,000. I know you live up the road, you're poverty stricken. You can barely feed your family. So what's your qualification to give me $20,000? No, I'm just, you know, from the source, I am delivering exactly that. You know, or he may be delivering some very wonderful, you know, books on transcendental literature. Here, this is, I know. Oh, what's your qualification? You're illiterate. No, I'm just... So, Prabhupada says that, you know, what makes one perfect, it has nothing to do with one's, you know, faults or disqualifications. What makes one perfect is that one follows what one has heard from the perfect source. One presents that exactly. What one has, you know, understood of what is the behavior of those perfectly situated, one is following the footsteps to follow that. That's what makes one perfect. Bali Maharaj is someone who is following in the footsteps of Prahlad Maharaj, and that makes him perfect. Not that he is perfect, that, you know, here he's bound by ropes, everything is taken off him, he's gone, you know, lost his bodily luster, he's obviously, you know, it's difficult, you know, he's struggling with the whole thing, you know, to Arjuna also losing his bodily luster, he's dropped his bow. It doesn't matter. They followed. Arjuna followed Krishna, what he wanted to do. Bali Maharaj is following Prahlad Maharaj, and that made him perfect. You know, Prabhupada, you know, if you listen to Prabhupada's lectures, you know, I've noticed this. Sometimes Prabhupada will say something, and then he'll stop himself and qualify it. You know, I can't remember the exact things, but it's like this. He'll say, you know, if someone does this yoga process, there's no benefit at all. Well, not exactly no benefit. There is some benefit. You know, he'll actually qualify himself. He'll actually go back and actually, you know, within, but he always does it within a split second. He does it straight away. He'll say something, and then he's heard himself, and he's thought, no, that, you know, that sounds wrong, and actually there is something, and he'll literally qualify it again. You see? So it's not as if, you know, like when, yes, Krishna's speaking to him, but he's also, you know, it doesn't mean that necessarily it comes out perfectly word for word straight away that he's speaking. It's not like there's a recording there and he's just, you know, it's just coming out straight from a recording from Krishna through his heart and he's just repeating what he's hearing in his ear. Not like that. He's speaking and he understands, I'll take that back sort of thing. Okay? You know, Prabhupada sometimes uses words. I was listening to a lecture the other day. He said you know, one may be a big business magnifier. You know, and of course what he meant was a big business magnet. not a magnate, you know, magnate. Because he said business magnifier. Yeah. So it's like a mistake. You know, it's like a language mistake, which is normal for someone who's, you know, learned English, you know, from his Scottish, you know, English sort of school where they have all sorts of, you know, then he's speaking in English, which is a second language. Prabhupada's use of words outshines even people who speak English. He's, you know, picking the exact words with the exact meanings. But then, you know, sometimes he'll say he when he means she and she when he means he and so many different things. So they're like imperfections. You know, he's like human in that sense. But at the same time, you know, the moment he senses that something is not exactly, you know, closer to what I've heard is more like this. So he'll pick himself up, is it? So, you know, our tendency to look at devotees, you know, that, oh, here's Bali Maharaj, you know, he's becoming, losing his luster. Where's this imperfection coming from? Actually, you would expect to see that. And that's not where we're looking, should be looking for perfection. Where we look for perfection, oh, that'd be normal. We'd all do that. We'd all lose our bodily luster. But what makes him perfect is how he is following exactly in the footsteps of Prahlad Maharaj. That's perfection. And therefore, it is that we should look for, in the same way we look for that in Prabhupada, that, you know, Prabhupada would say, you know, people say I am doing so many wonderful things, and of course, you know, people know that he's a pure devotee, Nitya Siddha, and so many different things. But he always made this point that, you know, if he's done anything that warrants any credit, or, you know, some people see him as this perfect, wonderful person, it's that he just didn't change the message that he was given. That's it. He's spiritual master, you know, he's heard from, this is the proper understanding, Gita, Bhagavatam. And he's presented that, he hasn't changed it, that's his perfection. Therefore, as he says, we may not be perfect, but then we are perfect because we're presenting exactly.
Prabhupada heard from spiritual master only a few times, maybe 10, 12 times or so.
Yeah.
Not a lot.
Mm. Yeah. Therefore, yes, but he heard enough to know that you don't speculate. that we take every word of the Bhagavatam and every word of the Bhagavad Gita and every commentary of the Acharyas, we take, if we don't understand that, then we just look what is in that scripture and we don't try and interpret it. We present it as it is. If it says, you know, Bali Maharaj, you know, it went pale, we think, oh, we should leave that out. It just doesn't sound right, you know. No, he went, lost his luster, you know. We don't change it. Just, that's what it says. So we try and understand what's there, not that we think, oh, you know, maybe there's some mistakes or something. And but it shows you that Bali Maharaj's perfection is the fact that after taking everything from him and being bound, it would affect him to the point where he'd lose his bodily luster. When you lose your bodily luster, it's like devastation. You've been devastated. There's probably a few times in life, you know, you'll experience that. I've had many, but but when you just lose your bodily luster, oh, what happened there? My God, everything's finished. I have no future from this point. And even in that position, he's not budging, as it says here, he's standing fast. Where are my glasses?
He's fixed in his determination.
Fixed in his determination. A pure devotee is never deviated from the service of the Lord despite all difficulties and impediments offered by the elusive energy. That's what qualifies one to be a pure devotee. Not that we look at someone having difficulty and that disqualifies them as a pure devotee. It's the opposite, that despite the difficulty that devotee is experiencing, they're not budging from their determination. Because sometimes what happens, you know, sometimes devotees, because they become envious of other devotees, especially if someone's, you know, in a high position, they want to drag them down. That's very common. And so if they see that they're having some difficulty, they take that as a sign that they're not a pure devotee or an elevated devotee. They can take that as a sign. They struggle. Oh, it's so pure, it's not so pure, it's not so transcendental. Or she's not so transcendental. And they do that. But factually, that's envy. But the thing is, one should look, my God, so much difficulty, and that devotee hasn't budged, you know, from their determination to do, to, you know, fulfill the obligation to their service to their spiritual master, to Prabhupada, to be, you know, to remember Krishna, to remember, to think of Krishna at that time, and to you know, like that. O King of the demons, you have promised to give me 3 steps of land. But if I have occupied the entire universe with 2 steps, now think about where I should put my 3rd step. As far as the sun and moon shine with the stars, and as far as the clouds pour rain, all the land throughout the universe is in your possession. Of these possessions, with 1 step, I have occupied Bhurloka. With my body, I have occupied the entire sky in all directions. And in your presence, with my 2nd step, I have occupied the upper planetary systems. Ambu, Bhavaha, Swa. So, purport, according to the Vedic description of the planetary systems, all the planets move from east to west. East to west. So let's see. So they move from east to west. Yeah. The sun, the moon, and 5 other planets, such as Mars and Jupiter, orbit one above another. Brahmada Dev, however, expanding his body and extending his steps, occupied the entire planetary system. So therefore some omens describe that when certain things move from an easterly direction or to an easterly direction, if crows are going that way or that way, or if swans are going this way or that way, it means something, because some things are considered to be going against the natural flow of the universe, which is inauspicious, and some things are going with that natural flow. So that's why the certain omens are like that. It's like, if cars are moving against the flow of traffic, it's inauspicious. So the traffic is that way, and omens are somehow connected with the natural flow of the planets and orbits, and rather than against them. So because you have been unable to give charity according to your promise, the rule is that you should go down to live in the hellish planets. Therefore, in accordance with the order of Sukracharya, your spiritual master, now go down and live there. So now he's inflicting this curse given by Sukracharya, who's rejected Vishnu. Sukracharya has rejected Lord Vamana, and he's punishing him according to Sukracharya's punishment. That'd be humiliating, wouldn't it?
He's given three steps. He's given the same.
He's given two steps, hasn't he?
No, the third step was his
head. No, he hasn't given.
He that's. Don't tell me the end of the story. My wife does that. You're watching something, I've seen the end of this. I said, don't tell me. Always tell me. Again, Nirmala?
No, but he still sends him after he gives him.
What's that? He's done two steps.
And also he goes, sends him to Sudan.
I'm going to push forward. It is said, and this is a quotation from 6:17:28 of the Srimad Bhagavatam, devotees solely engaged in the devotional service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayan, never fear any condition of life. For them, the heavenly planets, liberation, and the hellish planets are all the same, for such devotees are interested only in the service of the Lord. A devotee engaged in the service of Narayan is always in equilibrium. A devotee actually lives transcendentally. Although he may appear to have gone to hell or heaven, he does not live in either place. Rather, he always lives in Vaikuntha. Saganan Samatita Dandramba Guhaya Gopate. Vamadadev asked Bali Maharaj to go to the hellish planets, apparently just to show the entire universe how tolerant he was. And Bali Maharaj did not hesitate to carry out the order. A devotee does not live alone. Of course, everyone lives with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But because the devotee is engaged in his service, he actually does not live in any material condition. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, Kita Janmahal Yata Tuyadas. Thus he prays to take birth as an insignificant insect in the association of devotees. Because devotees are engaged in the service of the Lord, anyone who lives with them also lives in Vaikuntha. Far from being elevated to the heavenly planets or fulfilling one's desire, one who does not properly give a beggar what he has promised falls down to a hellish condition of life. Being falsely proud of your possessions, you promised to give me land, but you could not fulfill your promise. Therefore, because your promise was false, you must live for a few years in hellish life. The false prestige of thinking I am very rich and I possess such vast property is another side of material life. Everything belongs to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and no one else possesses anything. This is the real fact. Ishvasham idam savam yatkinchat akincha jagatcham jagat. Bali Maharaj was undoubtedly the most exalted devotee whereas previously he had maintained a misunderstanding due to false prestige. By the supreme will of the Lord, he now had to go to the hellish planets, but because he went there by the order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he lived there more opulently than one could expect to live in the planets of heaven. A devotee always lives with the Supreme Personality of Godhead engaged in his service, and therefore he is always transcendental to hellish or heavenly residences. So his understanding of Krishna consciousness is very, very good. That, you know, if the Lord wants me to go there, then everything will be, you know, Vaikuntha. If the Lord wants me to go there and I'm serving the Lord by executing his will, then that is Vaikuntha for me. And those who also, you know, take up that same service, then that'll be Vaikuntha for them. So, you know, sometimes, you know, sometimes in our movement, different disciples of Prabhupada would quarrel. You know, in the early days, Prabhupada mentioned how, you know, a lot of devotees were leaving because they were quarrelling amongst each other. Like I mentioned, same when he was elected. He said the difficulty was that they were writing back to Prabhupada, I've left but I can't stop thinking of Krishna. That's what Prabhupada mentioned that. But sometimes when there were quarrels, then amongst senior devotees especially, Prabhupada would ask one of them, well then, you know, you go to China, you go to Russia. They felt like Prabhupada was punishing them. You know? In one sense, it sort of was. In one sense, that, oh, if you're going to quarrel, I might have to separate you, and this is the result. So, you know, don't go quarrelling because you'll end up like him. Where's so-and-so? He went to Russia. Oh, he's quarrelling with the other devotee. There was in Russia. So, you know, Bali Maharaj is like that. You know, don't be proud of your possessions. You'll end up, everything will be taken off and you'll be sent to the hellish planets, like that. So it's there, but it's not actually a punishment, really. It's sending both messages. But really, a devotee knows that the punishment by the Lord or through his pure devotee is... it's not actually a punishment. It's it is always a blessing to accept that order in a mood of being the eternal servant of the Lord. So in that mood of service, and of course you see that some of those, you know, different devotees who have gone to different places in Russia and this and that and what have you. You know, now what, you know, would have seemed like a great burden in those days, now you go to those places, there are thousands and thousands of devotees and, you know, dozens and dozens of temples, and you can just go from one place to the other and there'll be, you know, so much opulence and so much prasadam, so many kirtans, like that. So many, you know, in the pastimes of Krishna, different incarnations in his devotees, so many, you know, at every step, so many things we can gain from it. You know. Everything is significant, everything is wonderful. Any comments or questions? And of course, you know, from that, you know, again, I look at it now, so, you know, sometimes devotees, I quite often hear devotees will say, how did you survive those early days in ISKCON, you know, some of those, there's some horror years, you know. Apparently, although, you know, Not really, you know, it was ecstatic actually. But it seemed, you know, it seemed that some of the service we had to do was the worst possible thing you could imagine yourself to be doing. I mean, myself, before being a devotee, I was basically a hippie. So hippie means you do what you want, when you want, every day, all day. You know, working means you run out of money, you work for 2 weeks. In those days, you could work for 2 weeks, you could end up with $1,000. And as a simple hippie, you know, you had no possessions, hitchhiking everywhere, that lasts you 6-8 months. You know, you'd only have to work a couple of weeks every now and then. And people would just give you a job like that. You just walk in, you know, a log and mill, building concrete water tanks, this, that and the other. And, but, you know, and then you just spend your day sitting on the beach, playing music. You meet someone, they say, oh, come and start in the house for a couple of weeks. And they say, oh, I've got some friends up north, can't visit them. Which way are you heading? I don't know. Got any friends up north? Yeah, go and visit them. So you just do it. Then, you know, to become a devotee, and then every minute of your day is under someone else's instruction. Every minute. The time you wait, there's no more sleeping in, you know. And the thing that you sort of revolted against most, money, you're now being asked to just think in terms, you get some, we need Lakshmi. That's what you'll be doing 9 to 5, 5 days a week, sometimes the weekends, marathons, every day, year in, year out. It's like the worst thing, you know, for someone like that, the worst thing you could imagine, you know. Everything was about freedom. And and then it's not just money, but then having to earn that money sometimes by wearing wigs, wearing disguises, you know, going to places you would never go. And then, you know, you're not as a hippies, you know, you like to be out in the country, walking around in the sunshine. Where you're spending all your days in the smoggy, you know, noisy, you know, industrial estates, and, you know, in the factories, and, you know, the abattoirs, and, you know, like that, day in, day out. And so it was quite, and it was almost the worst possible scenario you could imagine for yourself, except for the fact that you're doing it for Krishna, which was ecstatic. You're serving good. Otherwise, you could not imagine that there's no way you would ever do any of that and allow anyone to tell you what to do. Now when I look back on it, I understand that that process allowed me to literally forget all my notions of my... whatever my mind would say to me, I just had to say, you know, because your mind would just at you all day long. What are you doing? You know, what's going on here? Oh, well, you know, I'll read another verse of the Gita, get out of there, you know, and you sort of, you get to the point where you just never listen to your mind. You know, it's either coming from Shastra, it's coming from the spiritual authorities, it's coming from Guru, or whatever your mind says, you just don't listen anymore, even in the worst possible circumstances. And whatever your senses are saying, you don't listen, because you're just doing it day in, day out like that, in the worst possible situation. Now I look back at it, and I think such a valuable experience that if I had taken the slow path that devotees take these days, you know, pop along for the Sunday feast, fill yourself up with lots of bishalam, you know, enjoy the kirtan lecture, you wander home to your family, you know, a week later, come back again. I do a little service every now and then. And you can do that for 20, 30 years. If I had it, because my mind and senses were so uncontrolled, I would not have been able to become a devotee. If I join now, in the state I was in then, I would have just been dragged away to intoxication and, you know, stuff like that, because the conditioning was just so, you know, strong. So,
so is that why it's making it difficult to make new devotees?
No. We're actually making a lot of devotees, but especially here, a lot of Indian body devotees. But we're not making a lot of Westerners.
Yeah.
But I employed that policy on the farm. If people wanted to come to the farm, I used to, you know, work with them. But I, you know, we'd work every day, so that they wouldn't be sleeping and just eating. But the point is that when I look back, I can see that it was a benediction. It was an absolute must. It was an absolute must, you know, for myself. And it's, you know, as a devotee, it's sort of that you feel like you've gained this greatest asset, that you've had some intense training like that. But, you know, you go into an army, you know, they can give you a gun and a couple of hand grenades and the uniform, but if they don't give you any training, you think, you know, I really don't quite have the assets. I wish they had given me some intensive training to be, you know, a soldier like that. You know, so it was like that. I felt, yeah, gee, we really got the training. That was the asset, that you can just say, you know, push the mind aside. You know. And so, you know, people often come up to me during the day and say, how are you feeling? I said, I can't tell you now. I'll tell you when I get home. Because I don't think about it during the day. And literally block it out. And I actually get home. Sometimes, even now, I get home, and I can struggle to walk from my front door to the Sri Murti to the bedroom, where I literally crash. But I don't, you know, I don't know how I've driven home. And but it's you know, it's training where you just literally, you just don't think about your body, you don't think about your mind, you do your service, and you don't stop until your service is done. You know. Now, these days, you ask a devotee, you know, to do something a little difficult, and they'll just tell you straight out, you know, nah, not going to do it, you know. And, you know, it's, even if it's not difficult, but it's not what they wanted to do. Oh, I wanted to do that. But we need someone to do this now. That's okay, I want to do that, you know. So I can see now that what Krishna arranged for me, which then was looked like going to hell on a daily basis. I mean, some, you know, I used to go on a sankirtan with, you know, some of the Prabhupada disciples. And, you know, really solid devotees. And you'd walk into some places and they would just go, Ganga, I'm not going in there, you know. And my spiritual master never said for me to do that. And I'd be thinking, well, mine did. So I've got to go in there. You know, it's like the chicken factories and that. You've got the chickens coming round on the belt and you're standing there trying to sell someone a painting, and they're chopping the chicken's head off like that, and you go, and you're just having this conversation. You're just trying, you know, think, I'm gonna struggle to eat later today. And there's a chop, and so you're there with them about 15, and this belt comes round, the chickens come round, and they're just chopping their heads off like that, and they'll buy a painting, you know, and they pull their money out, they've got blood all over their hands and stuff like that. You give the money, you sort of wash the money later on, you know, in and out of the avatars, and, you know, even some really good sankirtan devotees, they just, no, that's it, can't get, I won't go into there. But, you know, you look back at it and you think to yourself, Krishna sent you to hell, but in fact, it allowed you to experience Vaikuntha, because you literally just had to transcend the body, the material world, you know, And what would happen is that I literally had to cut that out. So I always took a Bhagavad Gita and I would just read the verse from the Gita, and while I was talking to that person, I'm in my mind, I'm just thinking, why did Krishna say that to Arjuna? Or the verse that I read out is sort of playing out right in front of my hand. You know, we're talking about the super soul, you know, in the third, and I'm looking, you know, the super soul's in this person's heart, you know, and you're sort of waiting for little budge, he's not going to buy, he wants me to leave, he's not going to buy, and just a fraction of a moment, you see this little something happens with the super soul, say, now's my chance, come back, you know, $20, you're not going to miss it, come on, oh, okay, and bang, you know, and you're actually literally watching for a moment where the super soul says, this is your chance, going like that. So you sort of, you're there, and then you're in ecstasy, you know, of this poor person who's on his way to hell has now given some money to Krishna. Like that. Now this person is destined for hell. And, you know, Prabhupada, is, you know, he's got that opportunity. A little service, that'll protect him, like that, him or her. And I imagine, you know, you imagine, you know, this could be my brother, this could be my sister, you know, my child, like that. They don't know what they're doing. They just think it's normal, you know. And you wouldn't want anyone's child or sister to be in that circumstance. So then, you know, there's that ecstasy. So that is, you know, it is that sense of Krishna consciousness that really we should try to develop in our devotional service. We follow in the footsteps of Bali Maharaj. We don't follow in the footsteps of devotees, you know, that are reluctant to serve, you know, or procrastinating, or, you know, don't want to do anything difficult. Yeah. Not that we should force devotees to do things beyond their level of Krishna consciousness. But individually, we ourselves, if we want to become Krishna conscious and understand, transcend. I am a spirit soul, transcendental to this body. I have nothing to do with the body and the mind. And whatever the mind and the senses, I'm completely aloof. I'm just fixed as a soul in my service to Krishna, reciprocating with Krishna. And I just feel like I'm in Vaikuntha, even though I'm in the middle of this Ugra Karma. To get that, one has to follow Bali Maharaj, not neophytes. Not the, the ecstasy squad, as we used to call them. You know, you have the ecstasy crew. You know, they like the ecstasy part of ISKCON. They're always, you know, in that ecstasy, the ecstasy crew, we used to call them. They're always the easy stuff, the nice stuff part of it. The difficult stuff, they're nowhere to be seen. So we don't want to be part of the ecstasy crew. And we want to follow in the footsteps like Prabhupada. You know, dropped in the middle of New York. The spiritual master asked, so you go there. And even now he's 70 years old. I haven't executed that order. Krishna's made sure I'm not going to do it here in India. I've got to go. Krishna's forcing me out. I've just got to do it. We follow in the footsteps of that. And Prabhupada, in the middle of New York, in the middle of Atlanta, in the middle here, he would be, you know, in ecstasy, so much so that he could, you know, sometimes sing in the Jai Radha Madhavas, he'd be crying tears of ecstasy, both because of feeling the presence of Krishna and because how seeing so many different spirit souls, you know, being delivered, you know, from material existence. So this is what we learned from Bali Maharaj, Atmanivedanam. Mm. Any comments? Here we go, over time. Over to. There you go. Yeah, so we should be very careful, you know, we push ourselves in Krishna consciousness according to our ability to follow Bali Maharaj, etc. But we should be very careful about pushing others. But, you know, if we push others, it should be in such a way that we're sort of helping them. And we're also making it very relishable, and we're giving them a lot of realization, a lot of support. We don't want to push devotees without any support like that or beyond what they are willing to do. As Prabhupada said, all of Krishna consciousness is all voluntary. Whatever a devotee is doing should always be voluntary. We should never push devotees involuntarily. Again, if a devotee, you know, in our days, we wanted our godbrothers, you push me, you know, you compete with me like that. We wanted that. So we did that. But if we see a devotee doesn't want that, in those days, there were some who didn't want to be pushed that hard. They all got pushed along as well. We lost a lot of devotees. So we shouldn't push others unwillingly, but we should push ourselves. You push them, and if they say, don't do that, then don't. All right then. Sri Prabhupada ki jai, Pala Maharaj ki jai, Saint Kishan ki jai. Go to Pramanandi.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram.
So, now what happens next week?